Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. We're nearing the end of the year, so Sagar and I have one last Q&A discussion episode left coming out this Sunday. We've got plenty to discuss, so to hear the full version, go to realignment.supercast.com, where you can also submit your own questions and comments. On to today's episode, my guest is The Atlantic's Tim Alberta, author of The Kingdom, The Power and Glory, American Evangelicals in an Age of Extremism, Evangelical Christianity's Relationship to Politics, Trump, and the Republican Party is one of the key realities that one needs to understand as we sit during our 2016 to 2024 political era. Despite Trump's moral flaws and lack of a traditionally conservative record, evangelicals supported him in exchange for victory and the resulting Supreme Court justices who went on to overturn Roe v. Wade, something more traditional and more religious conservatives failed to deliver on for almost 50 years. Today, the relationship, though, is at a crossroads. On the one hand, evangelicals are still clearly in Trump's camp, and rejected evangelical candidates like former Vice President Mike Pence, the one would have expected them to support during previous pre-realignment eras of American politics. On the other hand, Republicans have received a severe backlash over abortion bans post-Roe, and Trump's explicit statement that the party needs to moderate is sure to cause tensions. Tim's last book was American Carnage, On the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. This book is much more personal, as he himself is an evangelical Christian and his father was a prominent pastor back home in Michigan, where all of the tensions described in the book are deeply present. No matter where you stand on these issues, the challenges facing the church in America as the country secularizes, the 2024 election forces folks to choose sides, and the abortion backlash comes to the center of the election, need to be explored. Huge thank you to the Foundation for American Innovation for supporting the work of this podcast. Hope you enjoy the conversation. Tim Alberta, welcome to The Realignment.
Marshall, thanks for having me. This is a treat. I am happy to be here.
Yeah, no, and I'm so excited to speak with you because there are a lot of these insert X group, insert X dynamic in the era of Trump books. And they're great books. I've had a lot of the journalists on the shows. But in this case, you are actually an evangelical. You're actually rooted in this community. There's a dynamic with your father and your childhood. So this isn't just sort of a repertorial, we're going to show up and like see what's happening. Like this is all like rooted together. So we'll do the interview addressing all those different dynamics. But like, let's just start here to keep it very simple. What do evangelicals want in the year 2023? Because if this were any year before Roe v. Wade were overturned, I could just maybe this would be oversimplifying these, but I could just say like, look, like ever since the late 1970s and the failure of Jimmy Carter to solidify evangelicals on the side of the center left, they've been solely focused on overturning Roe v. Wade and abortion, and all of their decisions can be understood as stemming from that reality. Whether that's a true or not narrative, it's definitely an oversimplification. That certainly can't be the narrative now as we move past Roe v. Wade. So how would you answer the question?
It's a heck of an opening question. I think I would probably say it this way. And let me give the full caveat first that, you know, I think I say this on like the second page of the book, that when we talk about evangelicals, white evangelicals, we're talking about tens of millions of people, right? There's a vast spectrum here. And part of the reason I wrote the book is to try to impress upon people and try to give an understanding of the nuance here and all of the divergent perspectives and behaviors and attitudes. And, you know, they run the full spectrum from like never Trump, totally apolitical evangelicals who just have never turned on talk radio in their lives, all the way to the sort of full hothouse MAGA Christian nationalist types who are trying to merge church and state. And then there's a lot of people in between. What I would say as one of the sort of unifying things that many evangelicals across that spectrum want circa 2023 is they want a return to an idyllic America in which Judeo-Christian values sort of seeped out of every crevice of the culture, in which the country's core institutions reflected their values and their lifestyles and their beliefs. They want a sort of reprieve from what they feel is like the relentless onslaught of the secular left. And I think it's that mentality, that feeling of almost being besieged by the culture and by unbelievers, by a government that is hostile to them, and by institutions that are hostile to them, that unifies a lot of these folks, even folks who have entirely different responses to that feeling of being under siege.
So here's what I'm really curious about. What year would you say folks are hearkening back to? Because normally there's just the cliche of like, oh, conservatives just want to live in the 1950s. But even take 2004, you're passing state constitutional amendments against gay marriage. So within, you know, my high school, middle school period to today, you still have evangelicals clearly setting the terms of debate and setting political norms for the country broadly. So I'm curious, like, what would you say would be this like years? And once again, obviously the 50s are always going to be peak everything when it comes to anyone hearkening back to the past. But what are different maybe demarcation points that a modern evangelical would say, like, oh, look, it's obviously not the 50s, but I just want things to feel like the way I felt in 2003, let's say.
No, it's a great point. And because look, like to your point about the 50s, you know, yes, this is predating Roe v. Wade. It's predating mass pornography distribution. It's predating the drug culture. It's predating, you know, the Supreme Court ruling on prayer in public schools. So like, yes, like, sure, that can be like almost the benchmark. But you're right in identifying that as recently as, you know, 2000 and really, I would almost argue like January 19th, 2009, it was almost an idyllic America. And of course, that's the day before Barack Obama is inaugurated. And I spent a lot of time in my first book writing about how the Obama years sort of radicalized a lot of reasonable, normal Republicans because there was this feeling of suddenly like the barbarians are at the gates and the sky is falling and the country is slipping away from us. And if we don't do something to reclaim it now, then we'll never get it back. And I write about that, obviously, in this book, but in a slightly different context, which is to say that when you take that sense of moral panic that I was just describing, and then you inject sort of religious existential stakes to it, suddenly you've got a bit of a dangerous situation. You've got a real volatility and almost an apocalyptic sense of, I suppose, to step back for a minute and make clear to people who did not grow up in the evangelical space and who almost need a translator for some of the language I'm using here. You know, for decades and decades, in the evangelical world, there has been this sort of long, festering, low simmering panic around the idea of like an eventual cosmic collision between the forces of the church, you know, the God-fearing, Bible-believing Christians, and the secular culture who rejects Jesus and rejects the church and ultimately is going to stage sort of a frontal assault against the church and try to eradicate Christianity from public life, right? That expectation, that sort of end times prophesying has been a big part of evangelicalism for the last several generations. And I think what's interesting is that a lot of the people who were pushing that doomsday stuff in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, they didn't actually believe it. I mean, they made a lot of money off of it. They built big followings. They became famous, but they didn't really believe it. They didn't believe that America was like on the brink of collapse. I think today the difference is a lot of them really do believe it. They really do feel as though the country has turned against them, and that America, because of its unique position in world history of spreading the gospel and doing missions work around the world, that a defeat of America is like a defeat of God. And that if they don't take this sort of this last stand and pull out all the stops to save their version of Christian America, then it's almost as though God himself will be defeated. And that's the sort of existential stakes here that we're dealing with.
I'm curious,
both from your position as an evangelical, but also as someone who writes about sociocultural political topics in our country, how do you assess the evangelical assessment of the broader culture's hostility towards evangelical beliefs? Because at a pure demographic level, we can use apocalyptic language and rhetoric and make that sound ridiculous, but obviously the commanding heights of culture, higher education, major corporations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, are, and when we say hostile, we don't mean like that they're going to put evangelicals in camps, which some people do allege. So I'm not saying that, but like obviously your average Madison Square Avenue ad executive or Fortune 500 CEO is not in agreement with and would almost certainly feel certain evangelical beliefs are contrary to their beliefs, interests, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So just talk me through your assessment of the, not the apocalypse, but the assessment that, like, look, we are under assault at a cultural level.
Yeah, it's a really smart observation on your part, because that fear is rooted in something real. There's no question that demographically, statistically, you know, at a social science level, you can see over a period of decades that there is a clear trajectory in which the country is secularizing at a really rapid clip, at an unprecedented clip in American history. You know, the rates of people who identify as Christian, the people who identify in believing in a higher power, the people who identify as weekly churchgoers, as monthly churchgoers. I mean, all of these figures are in pretty sharp decline. And at the same time, when you look across the board at, you know, I made mention of the Obama presidency, right? You know, Obama ran for president opposed to same-sex marriage, right? He remained opposed to same-sex marriage, at least publicly, until late in his first term. So we're talking like 2011, right? So that's like 12 years ago. That's not that long ago when someone who is viewed as sort of the paragon of progressive democratic virtue, Barack Obama, 12 years ago held a position that today would have an evangelical Christian in their workplace or in their social setting or whatever viewed as a bigot and as a deplorable and as someone who's like, you know, does not belong in a modern society. So in that sense,
and one quick pause, it's not to kind of like flesh this out too. And it's not that an evangelical in 2004 wouldn't believe that wealthy elite New York type folks would be hostile to them and see them as deplorable. It's that you literally had institutions like the Moral Majority where the presumption was, but it's those crazy ad executives who are in the minority. We can boycott. We can boycott them. We could pass ballot measures at a state level that disagree with them. It seems like the difference here now is that it's now the evangelicals who feel like they are in the minority position at a broader level.
I think that's exactly right. And so the two, there's sort of a macro and a micro, right? The micro is a feeling among a lot of these people that, look, if I hold this position on traditional marriage that Obama held 12 years ago, that I will be treated as a bigot and as someone who's sort of unwelcome in polite society, at the micro level, feeling as though the cultural shift has happened so abruptly and that they're on the wrong side of it. But at the macro, to connect back to what you were just saying, you know, we are indisputably heading toward a post-Christian America. We will be there probably within the next 15 to 20 years, statistically speaking. At one part of the book, I explore a brilliant speech given at Wheaton College in Illinois by an Australian theologian named John Dixon, who has come to the U.S. now basically on a missionary trip to try and help save the American church from what it is becoming. And Dixon talks about how in Australia, just a couple of years ago, the country became statistically post-Christian, and how that was met with sort of great media fanfare and also with a lot of kind of dread and consternation and concern from Christians there. But from Dixon's perspective, and certainly from mine as well, you know, Christianity has always found its strength in being countercultural. There has always, in fact, historically been almost an inverse relationship between the amount of social and cultural and political power held by Christians and the health of Christianity in that culture. In other words, power and influence and money and fame and holding those commanding heights often tends to be really corrupting and corrosive to Christianity, whereas being in that minority position is probably the best possible thing that could happen for the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's just something that American Christians have never been used to and is going to take a period of adjustment. And frankly, that period of adjustment is going to be really ugly and probably even really violent at times.
You know, what's interesting here is I am really not a fan of the whole, by 2050, America is going to be majority minority, because if you just, you know, living in Texas, especially too, like, it's pretty clear a more of a decent number of Hispanics will probably demographically like recategorize themselves as white. And like, what does being white even mean, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So like, it's something that we can kind of talk our way out of depending on how we change the words. But the demographic trend you're talking about, secularization, that is not something that you could say, change the words around and say, like, well, what does it mean to be evangelical? It's like, no, like, being evangelical actually means something very specific. So is basically what I'm asking you is this demographic decline, I guess, basically prove that it's inevitable? Or why should we just conclude that this isn't going to be something that we just got, like, and I'm sure you've seen this in the political discourse, the whole, oh, well, we thought, like, you know, Hispanics were always going to be for like Democrats, but now in certain places they're going more towards the Republican Party. I'm just always concerned about us making overarching statements about how trends could go. So why are you confident, broadly speaking, in the trend of secularization in a way that's going to put evangelicals in such a deleterious position?
Well, I'll give you a really perverse answer, and it's not meant to be witty or cute. It's just the truth. Part of the reason for my confidence in the secularization trajectory holding and maybe even intensifying is the church itself. In other words, when you look at polling from 30 or 40 years ago, you saw very clear patterns in which people who did not identify as Christians in this country held extremely positive views of Christianity, held very positive views of organized religion, of the church. That is completely changed now. People who are not a part of Christianity, people who specifically are not a part of evangelicalism, they hold incredibly negative views of organized religion, of Christianity, particularly of evangelicalism. In fact, many other people who identify as mainline Christians hold incredibly hostile views, negative views towards evangelicalism. So what you're seeing here is sort of generation over generation, an erosion of goodwill toward the church. And what that sort of translates to is a couple of things. For one thing, even the people who think about the folks who 20 or 30 years ago were just your kind of, they were a Christmas and Easter church family. And it just so happened that by going to church on one of those Christmases or one of those Easter mornings, that somebody in the family heard something that really struck a nerve and they became a Christian. And then they married a Christian spouse and they raised Christian kids, right? And they had that experience. Well, what you have today are so many people who would have 20 or 30 years ago been a part of that at least casual Christianity who today want nothing to do with it. They're not going to go to church. And the trickle-down effect of that is pretty pronounced. There are, when fewer people go to church, even casually, then fewer people become Christians. Fewer people engage with the church, build out a church community. And so it's not just the raw numbers necessarily of declining church membership, decreasing numbers of people who identify with the church or even identify as Christians. It's also what is the relationship between church and culture? And as recently as I would even say 15 or 20 years ago, that relationship was still reasonably healthy. It is now quite unhealthy. And that is an extremely difficult trend to turn around. And my sense is that unless the church, which is a big reason why I wrote the book, unless the church can kind of get out of its own way and stop putting up these barriers to entry, this younger generation, boy, if you want to talk about stark polling and really scary statistics, this younger generation, even including people who are predisposed to appreciate the teachings of Jesus and think that Christianity sort of in the abstract is a good thing, they're not going anywhere near a church because they don't want anything to do with what they see from the institution itself.
So here's something I'm fascinated by. Can you, as you're laying out this very doomer articulation of the challenges facing organized religion in this country, I'd love for you to break it down. Why is this a particular problem for the evangelical community? Because I recently finished McKay Coppins, your colleague McKay Coppins is Mitt Romney quasi bio, and it pointed out the interesting fact that in 2012, Mitt Romney actually increased at a polling level the positive perception of the Mormon church. So if we're talking about religion, we could say there are Mormons and there are Catholics, there's all these different ways. Why are evangelicals particularly bearing the brunt of the dynamic you're describing?
Well, I think it's because evangelicalism has almost become interchangeable with white conservative republicanism, and not by accident, right? What I try to document in the early stages of the book, particularly through the lens of Jerry Falwell Sr. and Liberty University, was that there was a strategic commingling of evangelicalism with right-wing republicanism. And even though you've had people push back on that individually, and there have been attempts to sort of disentangle that alliance, All of the organizational muscle and the money and the political power has been sort of vested in that alliance. And so, it's interesting, if you think about the average American and their perception of an evangelical, mm-hmm. And we see this again in the polling. There's been some really interesting polling just done in the last year on this question from the Public Religion Research Institute on the perception of evangelical. Incredibly negative, incredibly hostile. And then you start to unpack that a little bit. And it's not necessarily the belief system. It's not necessarily the social viewpoint. It's the sort of political antagonism. Mm-hmm. And I think that, part of the struggle here inside the church that I document in the book is that, you've got a lot of people who think the same way culturally, politically, and theologically. Their inclinations are very much the same, on paper. But when it comes to their comportment, to their demeanor, to their tactics, the question of the how, right? Not the what policies do you support, or the who do you vote for, but the how do you go about engaging the culture around you? That battle has been won inside the evangelical church by the people who have decided that the how is that they are going to flex their muscle and that they are going to be militant and that they are going to sort of wield the gospel as a weapon to win the culture wars rather than wield the gospel as a message to attract unbelievers to Christ. And that in and of itself is just fundamentally a different approach than you see from mainline Christians, from most Catholics, from other faith traditions. It is something that's pretty specific to white evangelicalism.
Yeah, quick question, because you've mentioned the white thing a couple of times. I want to understand it. Obviously there are evangelicals of all races, various, different churches, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Is there a, let's say, political perspective and institutional difference between Black, Hispanic, Asian evangelicals and white evangelicals?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think that there is, and I'll be careful with how I phrase some of this, but the first thing that we've seen in the studies in the social science over the years is that non-white Christians who hold the exact same sort of Reformed theological viewpoint, they themselves are far less likely to self-identify as evangelical. They're more likely to identify as being born again, but the term evangelical scares a lot of them off, particularly because of those sort of political implications I was describing a minute ago. Now, that being said, there are still plenty of non-white Christians who will self-identify as evangelical. But when you spend time around them, when you spend time in their churches, when you do sort of a case study here, as I've done with my reporting, you will find that even if there's great alignment on some of like the core cultural issues of the day. So take like transgenderism, right? Like you spend time around like Black or Hispanic or Asian evangelicals, and like they're right there with you, right? Like right there with their white counterparts on the question of transgenderism, or even in many cases, the question of same-sex marriage, right? They still hold to like fundamentally very conservative social positions. But as soon as you bring up like critical race theory, or you bring up George Floyd, or you bring up, you know, Obama being born in Kenya, like these people suddenly go, whoa, 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 whoa. Like, let's press pause for a minute. In other words, on some of the identitarian stuff that creeps into evangelicalism, that's where you see a real divergence around race. And that's why I will very intentionally, when talking about some of this, come back to white evangelicalism, because I think, like, if you consider the chaos inside the Southern Baptist Convention, for example, and I spend a lot of time in the book talking about the Southern Baptist Convention, you know, the SBC is the largest Protestant denomination in America, and it was specifically, strategically formed as a rebuke to the mainline Baptist tradition that was welcoming Black congregants and that was fighting for the abolition of the slave trade. So the SBC was formed as an explicitly pro-slave, white supremacist entity. That heritage is still visible today. Now, you have, of course, Black Southern Baptists, but they are caught in this crossfire inside the SBC, specifically when it comes to issues of racial reconciliation and criminal justice and questions of policing and all of this. There's a real uneasiness within the SBC as it pertains to race, and that is not an accident. That's very much, I think, almost that is the legacy of white evangelicalism as an institution, distinct from just Christianity as a whole.
You know, it's fascinating because the second you started explaining the identity level differences, that instantly synced with my understanding of this issue, in the sense that a lot of Black voters in 2008 voted for Barack Obama, but also supported Prop 8 banning gay marriage.
Yes.
So the difference here between a white, even once again, they're individuals, obviously, but at a broader demographic level, the difference here is POC evangelicals are still making different identity level political decisions than their white counterparts, in the sense that, like, if you're holding sociocultural conservative ties and you're white, you're going to vote Republican. But if you're Black Hispanic, you could entirely still vote to the left, because broader other issues, whether it's economics or like ethnicity and race, could be more important in the hierarchy there. That's really, really, really interesting. It also kind of speaks to it's kind of a defense of federalism in a sense, in the way that, like, if you could have, once again, this isn't me defending Prop 8, but like, it's helpful that you have a system where people don't have to just sort of perfectly tie their identity levels together in a unified way. You can have a Black voter say, yeah, Barack Obama, but obviously at my state level, I think this is about sociocultural issues.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that's exactly right. I think that's a perfect way to think.
So I think the next question would basically just be, so as I, you know, said, I'm Jewish, I'm secular. My dad is Catholic, but like not practicing. So I'm just very divorced from this space. So everything I'm just saying is kind of like reading your book and kind of just like thinking through the arguments. Could you tell me why it is correct to, or so let me just restate, because I want to be very delicate here. If I were an evangelical Christian, everything that you're writing about, like Trump and January 6th and the corruption, the chaos, all of those like very human flaws there, that would seem to pale before the broader stakes when it comes to the political issues that my church and I likely prioritize. So if I've grown up believing that Roe v. Wade is a modern Holocaust, it just seems that Donald Trump, especially when the choice of Hillary Clinton and she could nominate a bunch of Supreme Court justices. It just seems that that is going to pale, you know, in terms of like the actual stakes here. This has always just been a very like evangelical Trump Christian argument. I've been very not partial to, because I don't believe it, but I just have seen like, yeah, if I were evangelical, that'd be a pretty good argument. So I love, you don't have to like perfectly refute it, but can you just kind of like respond to the dynamic around the question? Because I think it's a fascinating one.
Well, yeah, sure. And I think that is obviously the argument that a lot of these people have made, which is that, listen, they entered into a transactional relationship with Donald Trump. Many of them were not enthused about him in 2016, but they promised him their votes and he promised them the policies that they want. I think there are two issues with that. First, what began as a transactional arrangement has morphed into something else entirely. Whereas evangelicals were Trump's softest supporters in 2016, they are now by far his most fervent and most loyal and unflinching supporters. And there is a cult-like attachment to Trump, the likes of which we have never seen in the evangelical political space before. It is not with precedent. So that's a problem, because for evangelical Christians who believe that they are called to be distinct from the world, that they are called to reflect the light of Jesus Christ into a world that needs it, and that they are called to be citizens of a kingdom that is not of this world, you can't have it both ways, right? You can't, on the one hand, say, well, Philippians 3:20 says that our citizenship is in heaven, and Jesus tells us that if we are to gain life, that we must first lose it, and that we are basically to shed our earthly identities and find our whole identity in Christ. But at the same time, hey, this culture is falling apart, and America's on its last leg, so the ends justify the means. You know, we got to do what we got to do. It doesn't really work that way. I think specific to the question about abortion, which is, you know, the number one thing that will be raised. And listen, like this is my family. These are my friends. These are the people I know who will make that argument. And I would simply say, you know, listen, for 50 years, many evangelicals who believe that abortion is not a political issue, they believe that it's a moral issue, an ethical issue, a spiritual issue, they nonetheless put all of their eggs into the political basket, right? They became single issue voters. They mobilized around Republican candidates, and they justified the behavior of these Republican candidates and rallied around them, even when these people were clearly doing and saying things that were unchristlike and anti-biblical. And they finally got what they wanted. They finally got Roe v. Wade struck down. And what was the result of it? More abortions after Roe v. Wade than before Roe v. Wade. And not only more abortions as a raw statistic, but you now have what was once a reasonably sort of well-regulated framework around abortion in this country, where partial birth abortion and where late-stage abortion was really almost non-existent statistically. You now have a Wild West atmosphere where states have, like where I live in Michigan, which once had, as of a couple of years ago, pretty tight abortion restrictions, now all the chains are off. You have red states, not purple states like Michigan, but red states that have passed ballot initiatives liberalizing the abortion laws there in ways that would have been absolutely unthinkable just a few years ago. My point here is that you think you're getting something when you enter into these transactional relationships. You think that the ends are going to justify the means, and you turn a blind eye to things that you would otherwise never turn a blind eye to. But what do you get out of it ultimately? You know, Mark 8:36, Jesus says, "What does it profit a man to gain the whole world but forfeit his soul?" And the fundamental problem inside Christianity today, as I see it, and I say this with humility because I'm a sinner of the worst sort. I'm a flawed person just like everybody else listening to this. But when we make these compromises because we believe that they are somehow advancing a greater good, that greater good is hollowed out in front of the eyes of an unbelieving world that is looking at us saying, you know, this end that they want so badly, I can get there without giving up a Sunday morning, right? This Christianity, it is no different. It's not distinct. They're not offering something to us that I can't get without going to church or without identifying as a believer in Jesus. And that is tragic to me because, you know, in one of his parables, one of his shortest parables, Jesus describes the kingdom of God as a treasure hidden in a field. And he says that a man found that treasure and he put it back in the ground and he ran off and he sold everything he had. He got rid of all of his possessions and he took the money from selling all of those things and he came back and he bought the field, right? And that is who we are called to be, that all of these other identities and allegiances and affiliations, that they are meaningless relative to that treasure. And yet I fear that we have found our treasure elsewhere. And as I said, I just think it's tragic.
You know, what's really interesting is your articulation of where the transaction goes wrong actually gets at like a structural difference between the Republican and Democratic parties, in the sense that the Democratic Party is best understood as like a mishmash of contradictory and sometimes reinforcing interest groups, right? And the Republican, and so for example, if you have, let's say, like progressives or leftists, or you have like unions, or you have like environmental voters or people who prioritize healthcare, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, they will vote for Joe Biden. They will vote for Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, et cetera. But very clearly, I think there's still like a rooted in their coalition aspect that's like demanding and going back and forth and very much sort of like, we're on the same team, but we are not one of the same. It seems clear that what happened here and what makes this less defensible post-2016 is you went from a version of, no, look, like Donald Trump needs to win. He needs every single vote he needs to get. We're going to give him this win. But if he doesn't deliver what we want from him, if he doesn't behave the way we want him to behave, we will punish him, pull back support, do et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They're just not operating coalitionally. There's just a total mixing of identities on a way I just don't see on the Democratic Party's left. I'm just curious how you think about that framework, because that just instantly came to mind as you're articulating this.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think part of what makes this evangelical dynamic that we are unpacking here so unique, like, for instance, I remember when Obama was elected and I was pretty new to Washington. I moved there late in the George W. Bush presidency to cover politics. And I remember Republicans and conservatives, both kind of in the media space, on talk radio and Fox News, but also just like at the grassroots level, people talking about like this cult of Obama, this cult of personality, how, you know, the people fainting at the rallies and this, that, and the other thing, right? And I think that there was probably some element of truth to that. And Obama certainly had an ego and enjoyed this incredible following that he built up and this incredible celebrity that he had. But what's so interesting is that the Trump phenomenon, specifically the evangelical alliance with Trump, is so different from anything we've ever seen. Like, consider the fact that in November of 2022, after Republicans had such a poor showing in the midterm elections, Trump comes out, and what does he do? He throws pro-lifers under the bus. He basically, like, right, and then rubs their face in it and says, like, you guys did this, right? You know, and then he carries on. Like, they're all, you know, some of the leaders of the pro-life community are outraged. And Trump doubles down. He carries on. And then he starts ripping on Ron DeSantis for passing the heartbeat bill in Florida. And he starts really aggressively taking on some pretty formidable pro-life leaders. And he starts to lose a little bit of support, not a ton, but some, like definitely at the activist level, right? People are kind of like turned off by this. But among the rank and file, it doesn't really move their support at all. And Trump doing and saying other things, specifically things that would have been just like Armageddon for evangelicals had they been said or done by Obama or by Bill Clinton. You know, he gets away with them. But then move forward. When Trump is indicted by Alvin Bragg, I'm going a little far afield of your question here, but stick with me.
It's okay, yeah.
When Trump is indicted, that first indictment lands in New York City from Alvin Bragg. This rallying effect around Trump, specifically from evangelicals, I think is really revealing, because it goes back to the point earlier about the transactional relationship. There's nothing transactional anymore, right? He's not in office. And yet, what did we start this podcast by talking about? It was the feeling of being under siege. It was the persecution complex, almost the martyrdom thing. And they see Trump indicted. They see Trump brought into the courtroom. They see Trump have to submit to a mugshot. And when Trump says, they're not doing this to me, they're doing it to get to you, it is, I think, a deep spiritual connection forged with these individuals in a way that we've never seen a politician forge that connection with any other voting bloc in this country. I sincerely believe that, and I'm a student of politics, a student of history. Trump instinctually understands, despite not being a Christian, despite not believing in any of the things that these people believe, he instinctually understands their moral panic and their deep-seated fear of being marginalized and being persecuted and being sort of pushed out of public life. And he has channeled it in a way that's forged a connection that I think, Marshall, like, you're going to have historians for hundreds of years trying to understand the sociology of this, but it's something that we don't have precedent for.
I think the thing that's interesting here is just that, and this is where, once again, the critique of the transactional politics bit is incorrect, or I think is correct. I think that evangelicals who feel like they're under assault are underestimating how Trump is quite obviously a stoker of the forces that they feel under assault by. It's like, obviously, I said, this isn't just my take, but it was just obviously true that, quote unquote, like the worst aspects of like 2020's wokeness would go on the retreat as soon as Donald Trump was not in office and was not as basically this. Like you could look at I'm reading a lot of like, you know, books on like, you know, higher education, like K-12. And like, you could see your most cringe, let's separate, you know, black kids and white kids in a classroom in order to get like equity. It's much harder to critique those when proponents of those policies are like, look, Donald Trump's in the White House. That is such a stain on America's moral nature that we need to go full 1619. This is just so obviously like a relationship between Trump empowering the forces that you could argue are going after Christian priorities. But I don't understand how they don't see that. So I guess basically here's the argument. Why wasn't, and I guess this goes to your point about Trump being just sort of an unprecedented force. It seems like the argument that Mike Pence or Ron DeSantis could have made was, oh yeah, you're under assault. This guy makes it worse for you. He gave you the only thing he was ever going to give you, which was overturning Roe v. Wade. Let's get someone who's not going to further the forces who you're against, who's not going to further the forces of like center left sociocultural like repression or pushback. Like, why weren't they able to make that argument? I mean, the primary is still going on, but Mike Pence is out. Mike Pompeo is out. Those are the two very evangelical candidates who could have made that argument. Like, why? Like, what went wrong for them?
Man, I think at some level, there's not a sophistication to make that argument among some of these people. Like, you're probably giving them too much credit. They would not have themselves been able to formulate that or thread that needle.
Quick pause. Thank you, because this isn't actually a transactional relationship. My articulation premises it on like, look, so everyone meets up in the smoke-filled room and it's like, evangelicals, in exchange for Trump, you get justice. But that's not what's happening here. This is vibes and feelings. So the argument that I'm making doesn't mean anything, because that's not, no one signed up to go to that meeting.
No, I think that's well said, right? Like you're describing a sort of a linear, rational progression of you know, 2 + 2 = 4, and this is how, but like that doesn't stand up when you are juxtaposing it with sort of raw supernatural fervor. And that's, I mean, that's what we're dealing with in a lot of ways. Like, I remember being at an event with Mike Pence. I think I wrote about this in the book, where he was in front of a largely Christian conservative audience, and it was like a perfectly polite reception. It was at a very dignified setting, but like there was just no passion for him in the room. And at one point, he was talking about his career in talk radio and how he was known as Rush Limbaugh on decaf. And he was saying, like, look, I can do all the same conservative things as Trump, but like I can also bring this country back together. I can reach out to my adversaries, and we can do this with dignity and humility and grace, right? And afterwards, like person after person who I was talking to were like, they were just, they had like this foreign gaze, like dignity and humility and like decaf. This one guy said to me, like, he said, like, we don't need decaf. Like, we need the real thing. Like, the left is overrunning this country, and the forces of secularism are coming for the church. Like, we need all the caffeine we can get. So it's interesting that in a way, one of the great enduring legacies of Trumpism will be that he rendered Pence's brand of the sort of William Wilberforce, genteel, endearing evangelicalism as no longer able to pass muster with evangelicals because they've been conditioned to need something more pugilistic. And I just don't know how that changes anytime soon, because this Trump thing that you and I are describing, it can't be unpacked at a sort of
interest groups exchange level. Yeah.
No, well, I mean, it's not there.
I think what's fascinating too, and once again, this is where I just honestly find myself sympathizing with the evangelicals who you're critiquing. It's like, look, if you were to say everything you said at the start of the episode about the stakes and the left and wokeness, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, Mike Pence would agree with all of those things to the letter.
Yeah.
Okay, but if that's true, then decaf just definitely isn't the answer. Right? It's like, even from like my person, I'm like, oh yeah, like if those are true, then Mike Pence, you're not going to get it done. Mike Pence just seems like in the same way that you could say, look, like, and I think this is the line that evangelicals who are on the Trump side increasingly say, look, George W. Bush, especially his like post born again version, is a good man. Where did that lead us? It actually led us into like Barack Obama's presidency. So I just feel as if like and they're not moderate. Like Mike Pence is by no means moderate. He's only moderate in the sense that we're in this post 2016 America moderate sense. But they just have kind of found themselves. They're kind of like an evolutionary dead end, it feels like, if the movement's premises are going to be considered accurate.
Well, let me push back on what you just said, then, because it makes sense to feel that way, to feel like you need all the caffeine you can get, that you need the brawler, it makes sense unless you follow someone who instructed you to love your neighbor and to love your enemy, and to not only love your enemy, but to pray for those who persecute you. You know, this is what gets lost in this entire sort of almost analytical exercise, is, you know, to be an evangelical Christian is to have pledged allegiance. I mean, that's what faith really means. It is allegiance. And in the first century Roman context, when you had Christians being fed to lions and burned alive and being crucified and living under brutal, dehumanizing Roman occupation, you had people like the Apostle Paul and like the disciple Peter writing in their letters, just reveling in their persecution and telling stories of praying for the people who were brutalizing them and sharing the gospel with them and bringing them to Jesus and instructing the followers in all of these early churches spread throughout the ancient world that no matter how you are treated, that your command from Jesus is to love these people, that no matter how badly you are oppressed, persecuted, even killed for your faith, that by responding with grace and love and humility, that you are drawing closer to Jesus and that you are advancing his gospel in the world. And so by responding to the under siege, barbarians are at the gates mentality, by hating our neighbor and by trying to own the libs and by escalating the culture wars, we are doing the exact opposite of what we are taught to do as Christians. And so I understand how, for someone who is not of a of the Christian faith, how they might hear that and think, well, that's crazy, that's soft, that's passive. Like, you know, Donald Trump's son said at one point, turning the other cheek, where has that ever gotten us? Well, if you're a Christian, you believe that turning the other cheek has gotten you eternal life with God, with your creator. And that is a heck of a lot more valuable than winning some election.
You know, I really appreciate the correction you offered, because as you're articulating it, when I was explaining, well, I understand why, you know, the decaf and the caffeinated, the only thing missing from my empathy was an understanding of evangelical Christianity. Because you're like, well, that's fair, Marshall. If you were a secular person who wasn't evangelical, who magically agreed on evangelicals on everything except for the whole Jesus thing, I could get why you were there. So yeah, I think that's a helpful corrective. Here's where I want to end. And this is where I just really worry. A lot of my understanding, like you're a little older than me, but we're part of like the same like broad millennial cohort. I worry that since the like aforementioned 1950s, so much of our broad political, socio-cultural project has been about tearing things down. So like, look, like the church of the 50s, the church of the 60s, 70s, et cetera, like the man, all these establishment institutions. But we've failed to be either prepared to or just build whatever comes next. So when we describe like a secularizing America and we see the statistics on depression and we see the whole insert bowling alone argument, everything's kind of falling apart there. I'm going to put it this way. Like when the new atheists like Richard Dawkins were really like, you know, Sam Harris, when they were at their peak in the mid 2000s, I think it was easy to say from like a center left, like coastal perspective, the end of religions on the horizon. And that's going to be a good thing. We should be excited for this new age of reason. I think it's pretty clear that as we move into that era, and this, of course, also brings to mind Ross Douthat's great quote where he says like, man, if you didn't like the Christian Republican Party, you're not going to like the post-Christian Republican Party. How should we be optimistic about this age of secularism, given, I think, the concerns I'm raising? Because it's not as if we found some reason-fueled alternative in a way I think we could have probably argued during like the height of like the Bush administration's overreach. That's a big question, but I'm just sort of, that's just like an emotion I'm having at the end of this conversation. Oh, I'd love to hear what you think about that.
Oh, geez. Listen, you know,
all of that in 2 seconds.
I was going to say, yeah, I'll try to do this in less than an hour. Boy, Marshall, what you're giving voice to there, if I can just take an opportunity to unapologetically proselytize for a moment. Like, I'm just a believer that when Jesus said, in this world, you have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world. Like, this place is broken. And I don't just mean, you know, humanity. I mean America, this culture, this society, it is fracturing, it is broken. We want to think we're special because of 1776 and the amazing things that have happened in this country. And like, America's a great place. I'm so grateful to have been born here. Don't get me wrong, but like, at the end of the day, history is filled with stories like ours. They rise, they fall, the next one rises, and it falls eventually. I think understanding the chaos and the trouble in this world through the lens of, you know, C.S. Lewis wrote that we know that a line is crooked because we know what a straight line looks like. Mm-hmm. And this world is crooked. But we who believe in Jesus, we know that there is something better. And honestly, without sounding corny or cliche or whatever, like my great optimism is rooted in the fact that God does love us so much that he became flesh, fully God, fully man, took on the cross, the perfect spotless sacrifice that they would find the perfect spotless lamb in the ancient world to sacrifice for the sins of the community. He becomes the perfect sacrifice for humanity to save us from this chaos, from this brokenness, from this wreckage. The amazing thing about Dawkins and Harris and the rest is that they will criticize Christianity as anti-intellectual when in fact there's been no greater intellectual exercise in the history of the world than understanding the gospel and its true meaning. You know, people like Francis Collins, who formerly led the National Institute of Health and who mapped the human genome, for crying out loud. You know, Francis Collins is an evangelical Christian. There are a lot of brilliant evangelical Christians who can do justice to this and articulate it in a way that I can never hope to. But I guess my answer to your question is that even as the American project that you're describing continues to crumble, which I believe, frankly, that it will, I do not have great optimism for this country over the long haul, because I think that some of the incentive structures and the institutional problems we have are all pointing in the wrong direction. And I feel that we don't necessarily have the mediating forces in our society to help heal these wounds. I hope that I'm wrong, but I fear that I'm right. Even as I observe that on the one hand, and I'm pessimistic, I'm greatly optimistic about a message of redemption for that brokenness and salvation from that state of helplessness and despair that so many of us feel right. And if I please have done my duty here to the kingdom.
I think that is a unprecedented, but also excellent place to end on this podcast. Tim, this has been really great. The book is The Kingdom, the Power and the Glory, American Evangelicals in an Age of Extremism. Seriously, as a Jew, you've given me a lot to think about, just because I think anyone who's listened to this conversation can tell that, like, you're once again not writing this as a outside reporter. Like, everything you're writing about is stemming from your beliefs and your experiences and your family and the way the past years have gone. So I think that makes it worth engaging with on its own. Thanks for joining me on the show.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. Thanks, Eric.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.